By Marcus Strickland. Hola, yo me llamo Dave Douglas. Esto es el Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. I was just in Madrid and I promised a listener I would speak some Spanish on the podcast, so there you have it. This episode is devoted to the music of Marcus Strickland, multi-reed player, composer, Blue Note recording artist, and going to be hearing excerpts from his latest release, Nihil Novi. It was produced by Michelle Endegocello and features a lot of great players. All the information is at our website, as always, greenleafmusic.com. And please visit and come and subscribe to the label under our new Bandcamp for Labels model, which gives you access to the entire catalog as well as a bunch of exclusive tracks that only get released that way to subscribers. But for this podcast, you can get it at iTunes or at Greenleaf Music or Stitcher or wherever you get podcasts. And it's a free service of just people that I admire and music that I love and love to share. So thanks for listening. You can email me directly. It's podcast@greenleafmusic.com. My name's Dave. I do speak some Spanish. And now we'll get on to the interview with Marcus Strickland. Thanks. Marcus Strickland, thanks so much for joining me.
Man, thank you for having me, man.
It's great to see you. It's been a long time.
Great time. It's cool, man.
I love this record, this Blue Note thing, Nihil Novi, which I guess means...
Nothing new in Latin.
Nothing new under the sun, or what is it?
Yeah, the whole phrase is Nihil Novi Sub Sole, which is, yeah, nothing new under the sun.
And what's, yeah.
This phrase was coined by King Solomon. Mm. Biblical times.
That's like back in the 1960s. Sorry.
Oh my God.
No, a little older than that.
Slightly. A little BC on there. But it's a phrase that when I first heard it, of course, shocked me. You know, it's like nothing new under the sun. What the hell? But the more I thought about it, and the older I grew, the more it changed meaning and meant more to me. Definitely started meaning something towards me, this project, because, you know, there's so many contrived things that somebody can do to try to make things new or spectacular. But what I'm finding through each record these days is that all I have to do is dig a little deeper into my history, to my childhood, to what things that just naturally were around me, and that I find to be unique. Like, the more that I travel around, the more that I find that what I came up in is actually a unique thing.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you're from Florida originally, right?
Yeah, Miami, Florida.
And so that's, you know, I listened through again to this record because I listened to it when it came out. I wouldn't have connected it with that way of thinking, because the composition is so forward-looking.
Yeah.
And the way that you're integrating all the multi-reads is really fresh.
Oh, thanks, man.
And so in what way do you feel like this was looking back to your own?
Oh, man, it would have to be just my musical upbringing. Without even knowing it, I was getting the best musical education I could have when I was even when I was in the womb. Like, my dad would put music up to the womb while both me and my brother were in there. Mm-hmm. And shortly after we came out, we were rocking in these little tiny rocking chairs.
Wow.
And he would put on all kinds of music on his open reel deck system. Mm. He had Stevie Wonder, and then he would play Coltrane, play some Freddie Hubbard, Jimi Hendrix. He was just all over the place. It never was a lane that he was trying to follow, or, you know, he was also a very great DJ in his college days.
Wow.
So he put together some great tapes also that he would play in the car. So I was always surrounded by music.
Wow.
And it was
you and your brother. And it should be said that Marcus has a identical twin named EJ Strickland.
Exactly.
He's an amazing drummer.
Yes,
and
he is.
They've pulled a fast one on me many times. And I'm pretty sure that I'm talking to Marcus right now.
But, are you sure?
So we'll just list this episode of the podcast as Marcus or EJ Strickland. But I assume, you know, since we're talking about the multi-reads, it's definitely it's Marcus.
We'll see. We'll see with the more questions you get.
So that's a wide-ranging background in music listening.
Yeah, it was.
It's a blessing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it really is a blessing. The more I get old, the more I understand how special that was. It really has given me the necessary tools to make the music that I'm making now. You know, so it's almost like going two ways at the same time, backward and forward. And it's a very interesting way that I got to this record. It also came from making beats, you know, like I'd play with Roy Haynes, play some straight up bebop, and then that same night I'd be sampling and making beats, and it's heavily into Jay Dilla and also Madlib, which also weirdly gets me to the multi-reads that I started messing with.
Oh, how's that?
Madlib is an incredible sampler. His musical taste is very eclectic. I think his dad is a jazz musician, was a jazz musician himself, who played bass, I think. But he had so many samples of low woodwinds, like in chamber type settings. He would have those samples running under the lyricist.
Which records in particular are you talking about?
There's this one called, I know that there's a track on it called Meat Grinder, but it might be Mad Villainy Volume 1 or 2. I gotta go back to it.
Me too, apparently. That sounds great.
Yeah, and it's just, and he also has a track called Accordion, and it has an accordion in the background. It's probably slowed down, so it sounds even lower.
But it's that reed sound.
Yeah, it gets that reed sound, you know. So that sound was in my ears for a long time, and I think one day I was just like, man, let me. I think it was after this monk competition. I got a little bit of money, and I was like, let me try to buy a bass clarinet. I bought one on eBay.
I thought you were going to say you bought an accordion. It's not that funny. Come on. I have a lot of friends that are accordion players. So you got a bass clarinet. That was when, I think I remember that. I think we were still doing Keystone at that time.
Yeah, that was a lot ago, man.
Yeah.
It might have been 2002.
Yeah, early, yeah.
Wow, man. Yeah, it's a long time ago. But and around this time, I was like, okay, let me just pick up this thing and see what's going on. I mean, I fell in love with the instrument immediately.
Yeah.
When I hit the lowest note, it made my eyeballs vibrate. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, I've got to play this thing. That's kind of cool, man.
You know. Well, the way you use it compositionally on this record, too, is really an important part of it. The way that you're, not just that you're overdubbing all the multi-reeds, but also the writing is really fresh harmonically and going some different directions. Was that a specific thing that you were thinking about as you wrote the music for the record?
It was definitely something that I've been learning through making beats, because I think in jazz composition, there's more fluidity rhythm wise. People have kicks all over the place,
and
they have harmonic changes that are not even that diatonic all over the place in modern jazz composition. I had been composing like that for so long, but then when I was making the beats, I realized that type of approach towards harmony does not fit with the beat. It's the bass line, how melodic the bass line is, how it fits with the drums, also the keys, how they float above all that's going on underneath. It's a very specific thing that makes people groove to the beat. And you only got four bars, about four bars of music, and you have to make it matter, because they're going to be listening to that for the next 3 minutes over and over and over again. So it's
also the harmonics that are implied in the sounds of the beats themselves, seems to me. I don't know that much about it, but it seems like it's more like musique concrète in the fact that you're using this recorded source, and then there's so many hidden qualities in there that are very subtle.
Yes,
and that the whole track has to work together as a whole,
exactly,
at the service of what's in those DNA elements of the sound.
Definitely, yeah. It becomes much more of an intricate thing than a complex thing, and that's where all the layers come from. In these compositions, with beats, it's like the most minute thing that happens in one layer is the difference between somebody nodding their head or going to sleep on the loop. So,
Well, also, one thing I would say, and hearing some of the tracks on this record, feeling the same way, that I often, like you said, you got four bars and the person's going to be listening to this for the next 3 minutes, so it better be good.
Exactly.
When this is done well, as a listener, I often feel like, wow, what is it about that little clip that's so hip that we can hear that over and over again, and it makes the whole thing happen.
And I
often couldn't tell you, and you know, maybe that's no different than any other kind of music.
Yeah.
Why is that so great? Mm-hmm. But the thing that's different for me is somebody made a decision.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put this on repeat, and this is going to be the basis of this music.
Yeah,
and that's a heavy decision, and
I realize,
how is that decision made? That's a little mysterious to me.
Yeah, it's very, I've checked out a lot of masters at sampling, like I mentioned before with Jay Dilla and also Madlib. Also, to my surprise, just checking out all the hip hop that I was checking out at that time, Q-Tip is an incredible sampler.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. the stuff that he sampled for Tribe Called Quest is absolutely amazing. Like the way that he cut up the sample, maybe sped up or slowed down the sample, and also put it together so that the loop would have validity or life for the next 3 minutes is incredible.
Well, also, yeah, constant sense of flow too, yeah, change.
Definitely.
I mean, Kendrick Lamar having won this big award, which was announced yesterday.
Yeah.
I think that's just incredible. So amazing for the whole art form.
I'm loving it.
Wonderful.
Man. Definitely, yeah. And, you know, it's, I feel just as greatly about, I mean, probably even more, but like, you know, when I did this project with Mos Def not too long ago, and at the time, no rapper had been in Carnegie Hall. And we did this concert in Carnegie Hall. And Gil Scott-Heron was still alive at that point. Mm-hmm. So we had Gil Scott-Heron come on the stage.
Wow.
And that was an incredible moment. I remember it bringing Mos Def to tears.
Yeah.
To have Gil Scott-Heron just come up on stage and say, wow.
History.
We're here on this stage. You know, that was a very, very powerful moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm liking that all these firsts are starting to happen. It's a lot of paradigm shifts. I feel that the kids that are being born today are going to have a totally different view because of these firsts that are happening.
Well, and you're part of a big group of musicians who are creating a lot of those firsts,
thank you, man. Yeah.
That must feel pretty powerful.
It definitely does, man. It's something that sometimes you don't even really realize until retrospect happens. But I really feel that I came up at a very special time. Especially, I mean, we were talking a little bit about when I went to school here at the New School, '98 to 2001. I mean, Robert Glasper was in the same class. Mike Marino. Keon Harold, Bilal, he was here. Georgia Ann Muldrow was here. All these people are just doing incredible things with music in general. It doesn't even matter if it's jazz or not.
Right.
And all those people were here, man. Start thinking about that. I'm like, wow, this was an incredible time to come up in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, bringing back to the music. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like a big part of, I don't want to say new jazz, or I just want to say a lot of the music that's happening, let's say. Let's not put any labels on it. But the production is such a big,
yeah.
A studio production is such is a bigger element in the music than maybe it was 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Definitely,
I mean, Tio Macero started cutting and splicing and moving things around a long time ago, but the level that it happens now, I mean, I feel like the production is as much a part of this album as the composition or the reed playing or all the wonderful side musicians.
Oh, definitely, it is, and I really, I'm so glad that I took the route that I did. With
Michelle Andegeocello produced it.
Yeah, getting the cojones to ask her to produce this record was a feat in itself, and then having her actually do it was the most incredible dream that came true. I had been listening to her records so long before that, and understanding that this was very special music. It wasn't really attached to a genre. It was her, and it was her time, how she sees time, all that stuff was in the music, so personalized. I feel the same way about Stevie Wonder. And, you know, it's so to work with somebody that I look up to so much was such a blessing. And she goes all the way with everything that she approaches, man. She's just all in. Or nothing, you know? So, and also seeing her in the studio was an amazing view, because she uses the studio as yet another instrument, you know? It's amazing how much she uses her knowledge of it to bring out what's going on in the studio, and that's all about what production is, you know. So I really appreciated seeing that firsthand. So different than just going in and saying, "Okay, man, second take."
Well, and your tunes were well served and probably mm-hmm. conceived with mm-hmm. that in mind, with that approach yeah. in mind. And definitely, I think yeah. it just seems like the collaboration with Michelle really worked mm-hmm. because it was both of your visions for definitely. What the music should be.
Yeah.
I'm gonna play a little bit of this track, Alive.
Sure.
And we'll talk some more. From Marcus Strickland's Nihil Novi, and it's produced by Michelle Andegiocello, as we were discussing, but also Keon Harold on trumpet.
Yes.
He's not a bad player.
As oh, man. So amazing, man. His sound is so rich, man. Yeah.
You've known him a long time.
Yeah. We actually took a Japanese class here at New School in Eugene Lang, and we were pretty good in it, and that's where I really got to know him as a person. I was like, man, this guy is super cool, man. Got to hang some more.
Wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And do you speak Japanese? Does he speak Japanese?
Yeah, I guess we can both speak Japanese pretty well, but wow. not nearly as good as when we took that semester.
All right, okay. Wow, and Jean Baylor is singing there?
Yes, her voice is like butter, man.
Yeah,
incredible, amazing. Man.
You said she wrote the lyric.
Yeah, her lyrics are just as on par with her singing. She's a first take wonder. There's never a time where we thought that there needed to be any other take. And also, she wrote those lyrics mm-hmm. within a few hours. Just wow. like probably two, probably no more than two.
Yeah.
And when she finally said, okay, I got it, and she laid it down, you know, we're at the Baylor's crib, you know, Marcus Baylor's there. He's doing some incredible engineering job, actually, because we used the actual vocals she laid down there. There was not really a need to have her
go to the studio. She didn't come in the studio.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. but also where it falls in the mix, where it's laid in from a production standpoint. It really
Definitely. It's I had an A team all around.
Who else is on? It's Twilife is the name of your band.
Yes, and Twilife, the band right now, the core band is Charles Haynes, Mitchie. Well, we call him Mitchie Time all the time, but his name is Mitch Henry. Mm. He plays keys and organ. And Kyle Miles, incredible bass player, looks like a young Ron Carter, but plays electric bass like no other person. He's incredible. Mm. So that's like the core of the band, that, that quartet. And then we have Yuki, Big Yuki on synthesizers on a few tracks. Robert Glasper plays on one track. Chris Dave does production on a few tracks and plays drums. Pino Palladino plays bass as well. James Francis on synthesizers for Drive, actually. Chris Bruce on guitar on Sissoko.
Nice to be on Blue Note.
Yeah, right? It's very cool. So we can bring all those elements in, man. It was very cool.
Wow, that's great. Mm-hmm. And you're still writing for this band, right? I mean, it's an ongoing...
Yeah, it's a, I call it a, my playground. You know, I feel I can do anything I want, you know, and because of the way I set it up, there's no, there's not really any limit to what we can do on each record, you know.
But do you travel with all the reeds? I mean, how do these days?
Yeah, I just got back from my first outing with all four of my horns on the road.
So wait, it's... tenor and soprano, of course, bass clarinet.
Mm-hmm. Bass clarinet and
straight alto. Straight alto or just
alto? Regular curved alto.
You play a lot of alto on this record.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Never played
it,
alto in my band. It happened. Something I said.
Oh, man. People have been so scared of using me on alto, man. But I'm getting it to sound much better these days. I feel alto is the hardest of all the horns that I play.
Huh.
There's something about it. It's like the maybe the straight neck or something that makes it so much more harsh. So you have to control the air much more than the other horns.
Even more than soprano?
More than soprano, yeah. Wow. There's some inherent pushback on the soprano. I don't know exactly where that's coming from. Maybe the size of the horn or something like that?
Yeah, maybe because the neck is smaller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What? So, okay, you must have a flight case for the bass clarinet then, because they're not going to let you carry all those right into the...
Well, actually, I just bought a Wiseman case. It's a cylinder, and on either side is my bass clarinet and my soprano. And it goes together as a cylinder, and... I can put it in just about any...
Yeah, but then what about the tenor and the alto?
Well, the tenor, I have a Michael Manning case. It's built to possibly be checked in, but if I am to check it in, I try to get it gate-checked.
Right.
And on this trip, I didn't have to check it at all, actually.
What about the alto, then?
The alto, I had my bass player carry it for me.
Okay, now the truth comes out. Now we know.
Yeah. So I had those two cases, the one on my back with the bass clarinet and soprano and my tenor, and then my bass player was carrying.
So you can play all the parts from all of these compositions, and I'm assuming all the new ones, because I know you're working on the next record.
Definitely. That one has even more. Even more woodwinds.
So was it worth it, bringing all four horns?
It was a paradise, man. I was in woodwind heaven and playing each of those.
You gotta find four reeds every night. That's crazy,
man. It took forever to set up and break down, but it was so worth it, man. I to play all of them back to back each night and learn how to switch in between the embouchures right then and there. It was training that I could never get from the practice room, you know?
Yeah, well, a lot of people like to go on the road and just play the music, so I think it's admirable that you think of it as a training. I'm like, you already got the gig. Come out here with four horns.
It definitely, like, I guess I approach it that way because it's definitely still a learning experience for me to play each of those horns back to back. It's such a different way.
Well, they're in different keys.
Keys, different pressure, air pressure, and all kinds of things. It's a new thing to me. I'm sure that somebody like Scott Robinson would be like, oh, that's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I play with Joe Lovano a fair amount, and I asked him this when I talked to him, like, because he plays the mezzo soprano, which is in G, I believe.
Oh my God.
You know, and so he's got all these different E flat alto clarinet and the B flat tenor, and I think, and I don't know if maybe this is the same for you or not. You tell me. But he said, you know, something about learning all the music in the different keys gets you deeper into the music itself in the first place.
That it definitely does. It pushes you in a way that you can't be pushed if you're on just one instrument or just playing in one key or playing the same size instrument all the time. You know, so it just gives you a different environment to work with. And it actually forces you to use other senses.
Right, and you have to think different. And you know, a tune that you're learning on bass clarinet, you're not going to play the same way that you do one that you're playing alto.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I'm just a one-horn guy.
I respect that too, man. You know, it's you know, sometimes I just feel like throwing them all away and just playing one again. It's a lot of stress.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I wanted to play this track that's called Sissoko's Voyage. Mm-hmm. And of all the tracks that I was listening to, this one seemed like it had the most direct, you know, based on pre-existing beats that you made from found recordings. Am I off base on that?
I feel so, yeah, probably so.
It's got a real rooted.
Yeah, it's like the bass line and also the sample that I had on the original beat, all that stuff's like really fit in so well, so it's like that remained when we started arranging it.
Is there a story behind the tune itself, or?
Oh, definitely. I was introduced to the music of Bazumana Sissoko years ago. I believe one of my friends, Petra Richterova, probably directed me towards Malian music, and also towards griots, the griot culture that comes from that part of the world. And when I came across Bazumana Sissoko, knowing that Sissoko is a very important and popular name in Mali especially, when I came across him, I was like, oh my God, this guy was blind, he was a griot, he had all this incredible vocal power in his music. It sounds very spiritual, man, and I hope I brought the sample with me so you can hear it. But he was playing the
we'll find a way to slip that. Okay. I might even like edit it under this part of the conversation.
Oh, so dope, that would be dope. And he's also playing the African kora in Goni, I believe.
Duzungoni?
Yeah, Duzungoni. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just the most spiritual thing I ever heard. Mm. And I just, you know, I would just hear him play a cappella with that instrument. And there would be a few bars, I'd be like, what? And I'll just go back over and over and over again. Okay, I gotta edit that. And then I realized it was in five. Mm. Then I made this beat that my main concern with making beats is that people can dance to them, groove to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I basically shaped it so that people can still groove to it. And the beat expanded to in a song when I brought it to a record, a pre-production recording that I was doing with Michelle and the band. she said I like this tune. I really like this tune in five. Mm-hmm. And at the recording, she was like, I have a bridge that I would like to put on it. And she showed me the bridge and went to the key of B minor, I believe. And I was like, oh, okay, that, I'm liking that, yeah. And she said, yeah, I want you to just write a part over that. And, you know, she started opening me up to possibilities within that composition. And it really gave me the template for how I should approach other tunes when I was writing it from these beats, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because the beats were so monotonous, right?
No, but a lot of the horn lines sound like very spontaneous.
Yeah.
And also that you harmonized sometimes after the fact. Mm-hmm. Or there's even sections where there's a harmonizer on the trumpet itself.
Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. really functions like a section a little bit. And, and so that's really interesting that's what instigated.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of this.
Sure.
Soko's Voyage. So you're saying that's Michelle playing bass on that. She jumped in.
And
she made you write some of those horn lines.
Yes.
She was who's on drums again?
Charles Haynes.
Charles Haynes. Mm-hmm. That's a great track.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Do you feel like co-writing is something that you'll continue to do? Like, I know you were telling me that the next record, you want it to be alive. Like recorded live. So I'm assuming there won't be all the horn overdubs, for example, and the approach will be different.
Oh, there's
not going to be pre-production the way there is on this.
Oh, yeah. There's still a lot of that.
But on the new project.
On the new project. Uh-huh. However, the core of each tune is the live performance.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And, maybe after the fact we add things. Some of the things that we added were before. And the great thing about having the band that I have, specifically Charles Haynes, is that he plays incredibly to a click track.
Uh-huh.
He can play, and it'll sound like the most breathable beat, but he is right on the click.
Yeah.
And having that that kind of team allows me to basically have live production going on.
Right, the editing capabilities go up exponentially when you have that happening.
Definitely.
Gene Lake was the same,
mm-hmm.
and when we made that record, Moonshine,
mm-hmm.
it was a live gig,
and
we went in and
we
were able to get pretty surgical.
Definitely,
and change it up and do post-production. So that's how you're approaching this next one.
Yes, and it's there's something magical about that live performance that I really craved for this record. So I'm so glad that we got to it, because getting all these guys in the same room is very hard, first of all. And second of all, just having the enough time to just capture it and not in a forced way. We hardly did that many takes on most of the songs. And they were quite new to everybody when we recorded them. But it really goes to show that the whole band, the core band, has grown together in such a way that when I bring in stuff, they already know what I'm thinking.
They know what you're looking for,
They know what I'm looking for in the composition.
And then you have been developing it live, so has it been recorded already, the next project, or is it like on an upcoming tour? You've already recorded it.
Yeah, it's all
so you're doing the post-production now.
Yeah, most of the tracking has been done. I think maybe two tunes need a little bit more tracking with vocals, that is.
Uh-huh.
But the core of the tune is there already.
And when is that coming out?
Slated for fall at this point. Trying to be done with it by July and released by fall.
Fall of 2018 we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So whenever it is that you're listening to this, that's what we meant.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. On Blue Note.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That must be really a trip to be on a major label like that with the freedom to do really what you want to do.
Yeah, I couldn't ask for a better situation. It's totally something that I never expected to happen. I feel like I have even more freedom than when I was an independent artist.
But also
financially, I guess.
it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's a family of players now on Blue Note.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's a cohesiveness, there's a message, there's people playing together and going on tours and appearing on each other's records. And that's and everybody forward looking in a similar way, which I think is really it's funny, because in one way it's totally non-traditional, and in other ways it's more reflects the history of Blue Note as a label, right?
Yes, definitely. And I really enjoy that it feels so much like a family. You know, a good example is the Blue Note All-Star Band.
Yeah.
You know, we all came to New York around the same time. And it's just like, it feels like I'm back in college every time I get with those guys, because that's when we met. And it's a very good feeling every time we get together, and it doesn't feel forced at all, you know? It doesn't feel like that typical all-star thing where
it's kind of a movement a little bit, would you say? Does it feel like that?
Yeah, it definitely is. I feel that we all have kind of like a similar intention in mind. Probably Ambrose would probably be the most different from us in terms of where he's going, the direction that he's going. But it's a really refreshing thing that we're approaching the music with. You know, so many times people have tried to define jazz, and I think it's worthless to define it.
You know, you have my vote on that one. You're not
so
going to get any pushback from me.
So worthless to try to define it. But one thing that I've definitely found very worthy is just representing that your time and who you are and what you find important. And
well,
you
know, it feels like there's a social change element to a lot of what's happening in the music too.
Definitely.
This within roughly defined Blue Note All Star, you know, current day touring artists, and I think that's so great.
Yeah, man, and we all I think
it's a lot to change.
Yeah, and there's a lot of us are born around the dawn of hip hop. So it's like you had a generation that before us that were already maybe teenagers or in college when hip hop was out.
Yeah.
And then there's us who've seen nothing but hip hop and also have seen who have been exposed to the incredible heritage of jazz, and we don't
and
really
played
see
with
it.
A lot of the masters.
Yeah. And it doesn't really seem that separate to us. It just seems like a seamless thing to us. You know, there's been resistance from past generations when we mix this stuff together, but it fits together like so naturally for us. And it would probably be a disservice for us to keep it out. So like that's probably
but it's part of the moment too, wouldn't you say? I mean,
yeah, it definitely is.
Black Lives Matter and everything that's happening and Kaepernick and I mean
definitely.
It's time. It's long past time.
Yeah.
But now it's gotten to such a heightened moment because of who our president is.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God.
People are speaking out, saying things that you just can't believe would be said. And if they'd said it 30 years ago, you would have been shocked and just go ahead, you know.
Definitely.
So I just don't think you can separate what's happening in the music from what's happening in the bigger social arena.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's something that you would have to actually try very hard to ignore. It's there. It's in your face all the time.
Well, it's in your face all the time. I can ignore it if I want to, and you know, and that's the horrible thing about it.
Yeah, definitely.
So
it's an incredible time. I feel that. I was just getting asked this in an interview in Bari, Italy, about, they were talking about how Branford actually thinks it's a good thing that Trump got elected.
I have heard him say that.
They didn't really explain that, and I don't know exactly where he was coming from, but I would definitely guess that it would be that Trump is basically unveiling the ugly side of America, this part of America that
at least it's out in the open now would be the rationale, I think.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, and him being part of, like, the 1% that really benefits from his policies, it kind of makes everybody join together against him, you know? People that normally wouldn't even care about the other person's plight are starting to come together because of this.
All this intersection between the different movements and people waking up in various ways about different issues is incredibly important and powerful. And I think it's part of the music that we all make, whether we know it or not. And I just feel like to ignore it and pretend that it's not happening is not only sad, but it perpetuates the very evils that
It does.
Are happening.
Definitely does, yeah.
And it's I did not intend for this conversation to go this direction, but I guess I went there because I hear it in the music.
Yeah.
Not just your music, but
and
a lot of
the
people,
music of
not
today,
just the
yeah.
Blue Note Circle and the Revive and music group, and but everybody.
Yeah.
And it's a moment where it just feels like everybody has to step up, and there's no ownership, and there's no, you know, the intersections that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The only question is, what are you creating that's a positive vibration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's I think in retrospect, we're going to look at this day and age kind of like the way that we looked at the 70s.
Go on.
You know, I mean.
I'm not like, sure what you, go ahead. Yeah, no, well, I want to hear more about this.
Well, you know, a lot of times I just think to myself, I'm like, man, you know, for my demographic, it's not really a desirable thing to go back in time. But if I were to go back in time, I would pick 70s. The 70s.
Because of Archie Bunker? Or is it?
mostly because of the incredible political resistance that was going on at that time, the outspokenness that was in so many people's work, no matter what art form you could think of, and also it was just a time that, well, this is going to sound very nerdy compared to what I just said, but it was the time of analog synthesizers, man. Like that stuff was incredible, man. Just like hearing.
That's not nerdy.
Like, you know, Stevie Wonder, man, like Talking Book. You know, the fact that he played every single one of those notes and the voicings. Mm-hmm. Separately, it's an incredible time, man. Incredible time for music. A lot of the stuff that my dad was playing for us growing up came from that time too.
On the open reel deck.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I feel that period of time could not have happened had it not been for the Vietnam War, the things that preceded that made everybody say, wait, what's going on here? Agent Orange, all that stuff.
Well, National Endowment for the Arts, mm-hmm. The EPA was founded in that period, you know.
Wow.
Earth Day started, mm-hmm. and so there was movement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Boy, mm-hmm. let's hope that the Parkland kids and everybody involved in all these movements mm-hmm. can have that impact.
Yeah, that would be great, man.
You know?
Mm-hmm. So, I feel that this time is... We're going to look up back on it and be like, wow, man. I feel that it's going
to
be...
So I wanted to play this one other track, maybe mm-hmm. to go out, called mm-hmm. TikTok, and it seems like maybe mm-hmm. this feeds in with this conversation about time that we're having.
Definitely.
Just tell me a little bit about
this. Definitely. Well, TikTok is definitely something that... The whole concept came from the sample that I... that I cut up from Susana Baca, I believe.
Sure, Peruvian, I think.
Yeah. And this is like Afro-Peruvian uh-huh. record that my brother bought years ago. I was like, man, what are you listening to, man? That's so incredible. They're playing in three, but it sounds like, it doesn't sound like three, the way that they're phrasing it and everything. Mm-hmm. So I got this one track and I put it through a filter, and the what's that box? That box that you sit on.
The cajon?
Cajon, yeah. The cajon sounded like a clock when it was put through the filter.
Filter, yeah.
Yeah, it went from being dunk to dunk to like you heard all the highs of that instrument. And I was like, man, this beat has to be called TikTok. And when I made it, I made it with very short and small sounds. The bass drum was very soft and very short in resonance. And the snare sound was just like kind of like a muffled rim tap mm-hmm. that was very short too. Mm. So it could all sound like a working clock together. And with this beat, that informed the band how to play, and mm-hmm. it made this whole reference to time and how the repetition put you in this circle, you know, this endless circle, and how the way that we relate to time has a lot to do with how we, you know, we think of just about anything, you know. And one of the things that I found very urgent at making this record was finally doing exactly what I've been intending to do all this time. Those things were stifled by budget. They were stifled by my courage. All kinds of stuff.
Whatever kinds of limitations you thought you had.
Yeah. And, you know, all that stuff was finally put to rest so that this whole record could come out. So, you know, within the chant that's on TikTok, I say, I think we say, it's hard to remember the lyrics, but be who you are before the time fades. That's probably like the crux of the whole chant. You know, so TikTok is about so much so that's one of the main reasons that it was the opening track. It has a lot to do with how I was going in two different directions at the same time, back and forward at the same time. And and also, you know, I have a reference to an archaic language, you know, and that King Solomon said an incredible coined phrase in, you know, that becomes the title, Nihil Novi, you know. Like, so every kind of the whole concept and everything kind of comes from this one beat. TikTok.
Beautiful. Marcus, thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
For being with me. It's great talking to you. Stay safe out there.
Great to catch up with you, man.
Yeah. Definitely. All right. Cool. Best with everything. This is TikTok. Right.